Tonight on Banfield, the final unanswered question from the 2020 election. Did Donald Trump, despite all the evidence to the contrary, really believe that he won the election? Well, tonight we finally know. And a new question arises. Is it even going to matter in 2024? And if you think you've seen the horrors of January 6th from every possible angle, think again. Tonight, chilling new video of congressional leaders scrambling to do their constitutional duty and avoid being killed in the process. I'll speak with the rioter whose picture broke the internet when he stole the House Speaker's lectern. Does he think these hearings will change anything? And then, what's on your mind 26 days from the midterms? What's not in your wallet? Inflation is still on a tear, but it's not apparently hitting everyone the same. Is your city on the most inflated list? Also ahead, if not him, then who? The man who committed the Parkland massacre dodges the death penalty in Florida, and families want to know why. Is America's view of mental health affecting jury verdicts to take someone's life? And later, one degree of separation, not nearly enough for Kevin Bacon and the late notorious swindler Bernie Madoff. Now Bacon's coming clean on a real-life drama that cleaned him out. And everything's coming up pumpkins this close to Halloween, but those aren't jack-o'-lanterns at a border crossing in Texas, and it takes a lot more than just some pumpkins to trick those clever agents. It's all coming up on Banfield. Hello and welcome to Banfield. Tonight, we are less than a month away from midterm elections where more than half of the Republican candidates for state and federal offices say the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump. But Donald Trump is apparently not one of them. You heard me. Tonight, for the very first time, there is on-the-record evidence that in his own mind, he is not an election denier, that he knows he did not win, and that he knows he was not robbed, and that he knows he had no legitimate claim to a second term as president. Not my words, his. And there is evidence that he knew it long before the evidence and the events of January 6th. That's one of several breathtaking headlines today from what's likely the final hearing of the January 6th House Committee. The panel played testimony from former White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson, who recalled hearing Donald Trump tell his chief of staff words to the effect of, "I don't want people to know we lost. This is embarrassing. Figure it out. We need to figure it out. I don't want people to know that we lost." Separately, another former aide named Alyssa Farah described seeing Trump watching Joe Biden on television and saying, "Can you believe I lost to this effing guy?" As a parting shot, the committee voted unanimously to subpoena the 45th president of the United States. But this panel is going to cease to exist in January. That's when we're going to have a new Congress, and given Trump's instincts for delay and resistance, it is almost as certain he is not going to appear before that committee. Here's what he said today on Truth Social. Quote, "Why didn't the unselect committee ask me to testify months ago? Why did they wait until the very end, the final moments of their last meeting? Because the committee is a total bust that has only served to further divide our country, which, by the way, is doing very badly, a laughingstock all over the world." The committee also rolled out some never-before-seen images today of the Capitol riots, but this time a view we hadn't seen. It was the view that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the top Senate Democrat Chuck Schumer had as they were hiding from the mob in a secure location, but still trying to get on with the business of certifying the election.
"The door has been breached and people are gaining access into the Capitol.
We have got to get finished the proceedings or else it will have a complete victory.
Virginia Guard has been called in."
"You know, I'm just talking to Governor Northam. Yeah. And what he said is they sent 200 of state police and a unit of the National Guard.
They're breaking windows and going in, obviously ransacking our offices and all the rest of that. That's nothing. The concern we have about personal harm,
safety.
Personal safety is it just transcends everything. But the fact is, on any given day, they're breaking the law in many different ways. And quite frankly, much of it at the instigation of the President of the United States. And now, if he could at least somebody.
Yeah, why don't you get the President to tell them to leave the Capitol, Mr. Attorney General, in your law enforcement responsibility? A public statement they should all leave.
The overriding wish is to do it at the Capitol. What we are being told very directly is it's going to take days for the Capitol to be okay again. We've gotten a very bad report about the condition of the House floor with defecation and all that kind of thing as well. I don't think that that's hard to clean up, but I do think it is more from a security standpoint of making sure that everybody is out of the building, and how long will that take?
On January 6th, the rioters were storming the floor of the Senate. I spoke live on News Nation at that moment with one of those senators who ran for cover. Here's a little bit of my conversation with Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut as he and his colleagues were hunkered down amidst the chaos.
Are you safe, Senator?
We are safe, and we are determined to go back, finish the business of counting the vote, and make sure that Joe Biden is sworn in on January 20th as the next president of the United States.
The question heading into this year's elections and all the ones after this year's elections is, will the ugliness of 2020 even matter? Election deniers sailed through their primaries, but will they be punished next month or will they be rewarded? And what of the rioters? Has the passage of time and maybe some new information and maybe some prison sentences, has any of that changed any hearts and minds? Adam Johnson was a Trump supporter from Florida and a stay-at-home father of five who was so convinced that the election was stolen that he flew to Washington, D.C. and was at the front of the mob that tried to break into the House chamber. You have probably seen his picture. It is a pretty famous one. There's Johnson smiling and waving and wielding the lectern that belonged to Speaker Pelosi. Johnson bragged at the time that the picture, quote, broke the internet. And 2 days later, he was arrested. He pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor and was sentenced to 75 days in jail and a $5,000 fine. He now says he is not the man that he was on January 6th. And he joins me live tonight now with his attorneys, Dan Eckert and David Bigney. Thank you so much, Adam, for taking the time to talk to us, especially on a day like today. I guess I have this first question for you because it's one that struck so many of us most today. Hearing from the president's own statements that the election wasn't stolen, I'm embarrassed about this. Somebody do something about it. For God's sake, I don't want, you know, the people to know that I lost. But you've lost a lot. How does that make you feel?
Well, I mean, it is secondhand statements, right? It's not Trump saying it, it's someone saying he said something. I mean, I'm sure that he is also probably doubting what's going on. I know that his attorney general, Bill Barr, said that there's not evidence the election was stolen. We have the entire media saying the election was not stolen. So I think we have to consider all of that. But until Trump comes out and says the election was not stolen, it's up to him to either admit that or walk away from it.
But, I mean, you've probably seen people on trial before in a courtroom, and often the way it works is you have witnesses who get on a stand and under oath, like these people that we heard from today who made these statements, they swear under oath that this is what they heard and this is what they saw. And these are two different aides who told their boss what they saw and what they heard from the president. Their boss, who's Mark Meadows, chief of staff, isn't testifying right now. He's been fighting these subpoenas. But that's how that's how we work in this country. When you're under penalty of perjury and you swear something happens, that's considered evidence, and it's usually enough for a jury to consider someone guilty. But you don't feel the same way about what they say about the president believing that he lost but telling all of you he won?
That's not really the point I'm trying to make. I'm saying the country wants to hear that he does not believe it. I think a lot of Republicans aren't happy with what happened on January 6th. I think the majority of Democrats are certainly not happy with it. And I think to move forward, I think we should push past the outcome of the election of 2020 and look at how to restore our country.
So the amount that you lost in all of this, I mean, it's pretty colossal what you went through, right? I think it's a $5,000 fine, 75 days in jail, the public notoriety that you now have, you know, holding onto that lectern in celebration, that broke the internet. You were right. And all of this for now what appears to be sort of a hoax on you all, you know, that you should storm the Capitol and you should stop the transition of power, which is what our founding fathers, you know, decided this country would be based upon. Do you have something to say about your losses to Donald Trump?
I mean, I try to take personal responsibility. I'm my own man. I made my own choices. I made my own decisions. I shied away from how I feel about the day. There was violence that day. People were assaulting police officers. People were breaking windows and vandalizing. And I've always said that those people who did those things should be prosecuted. But there were a handful of people who were simply protesting. And if we look at the majority of charges, it is trespassing and nonviolent misdemeanors. And just like myself, a lot of us have gone to prison for crimes that typically don't end up in prison. And I don't have words for Trump. He is also his own man. I think that he should speak about this and say this is not the direction our country should be going in. I think he does have responsibility to say that January 6th was not a day to celebrate, and that there is a peaceful way to have questions and dissent. But again, attacking capitals, assaulting police officers is not the way to go about it.
Adam, do you think that Donald Trump owes you an apology for ginning you up and getting you to a point where you were at the front of that crowd?
I believe, again, I am my own man. I make my own decisions. I take personal responsibility. I was on trial for the crime that I committed, which was trespassing, and I was convicted of that, and I've apologized, and I'm trying to move forward. But I don't think that anyone needs to apologize to me. Again, I'm my own person. I made my own decisions.
Do you regret what you did, and do you still believe in the cause that you, regardless of what you did, do you still believe in the cause that sent you to D.C. to do this?
I think there's a rather large misconception about the reason people were there. I definitely think election integrity was something that the majority of people were concerned about, but it was also COVID lockdowns, it was vaccines or lose your job. There are many reasons people did not want to see things transpire the way they did. And now we're having conversations about World War III. The economy is in the gutter. People can't find work or don't want to work. And I don't think people are interested in my story or January 6th anymore. I think they are more interested in their grocery bills. They're more interested in their gas prices. And more interested if their children are going to be sent to war for a war that we do not want.
Yeah, oh, no, all fair points. I think we can all walk and chew gum at the same time. We can be upset about the lot that we're in economically, but we can also look at those pictures on January 6th and hear testimony under, again, penalty of perjury, saying that Donald Trump said he did believe that the election was stolen, but he was embarrassed and didn't want you all to know it, and wanted this, you know, to happen as he watched the television for 4 hours. So, you know, I want to bring your attorneys in if I can. David Bigney, you know, Adam said during all of this that if he had committed these acts in another country, he would have been on a firing wall, which is, I think, very true. I've been to a lot of those countries, and he probably wouldn't even had, you know, a first appearance. There would have been a hood, and that was it. But do you think what Adam got was a fair sentence?
Well, certainly I would have liked him to got to have received a better sentence. We would have liked him to get a time served and maybe a probationary sentence, no jail. But if you look at it from the perspective of what I call the Bykovsky theory of sentencing, he certainly fell within the range of what I think is fair, maybe towards the higher end, but it was still a fair sentence. Not what we wanted, but certainly reasonable.
And Dan, talk to me a little bit about this, the whole notion of where we find ourselves right now, the number of people, you know, who are facing a judge over being there that night. Do you think that many of them have had a change of heart, given what they've seen in the January 6th hearings, or do you even get a sense of what it's like for the defendants from January 6th going through their process while they're learning more and more about what was happening behind the scenes?
Well, I think it depends on the individual defendant. It does run the gamut. And like Adam was saying, I mean, there were people there that were, you know, hurting police officers, destroying property. There's other people that were wandering through aimlessly through the Capitol. So that's, you know, it's really hard to give you a general answer as to how people feel. I think that, you know, a lot of folks are finding out, and even those are, these are misdemeanor crimes, are finding out that the United States government has taken this extremely seriously. And the weight of the Justice Department, the FBI, and everybody else is being focused on these people. And I can tell you there's probably going to be hundreds of more arrests. I mean, there's a lot more people that are probably going to be arrested the next year or so for being in the Capitol.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of video and a lot of evidence, and you know how it works. I sure appreciate, Adam, you taking the time to talk to us about that. I can't imagine the last couple of years have been good for you, given what you've gone through and given what you're learning through these hearings as well. And, of course, David Bigney and Dan Eckhart, I really appreciate you both coming on as well. Thank you.
Thanks.
So, of course, there are really huge doubts, I think we can all say, as to whether all the stuff that happened today on Capitol Hill, these hearings, whether any of it is even being consumed by a lot of America, and particularly by Trump supporters. So I want to bring in Mark McKinnon. He is a former advisor to George W. Bush and John McCain. He's the co-host of Showtime's very popular series, The Circus, and he's also really smart about this stuff and doing it a long time. So, Mark, first and foremost, who's going to see what happened today? Who's going to see that evidence that I watched, you know, because I'm a journalist, I have to, right? Even if I wanted to or didn't want to, I'd be watching it, you know, wall to wall. But how many people who need to see it, who need to hear that the president was witnessed by two different people saying, I lost the damn election, but just don't tell any of those people, it's embarrassing.
Well, two things, Ashley. First of all, I'd say that Trump supporters won't see it at all. I mean, they're not going to hear it on the news outlets that they watch. It won't be reported. And to the extent they do hear about it, I think a lot of them will just say, you know, I knew that, and they don't really care. I mean, there is a predominant part of the Republican Party, it was 61%, who believed Donald Trump and said it was stolen, but there are others who are still supporting him that don't believe it was stolen. They still support him. So, I mean, we have an elector right now that is really split, and it's interesting because back in the spring, it looked like a huge Republican wave, Biden was underwater, and then we had the Dobbs decision. That kind of flipped the script for a while, and Democrats were animated. And also, by the way, not just over the abortion issue, but also on this issue about threats to our democracy, that we've seen that rise. I've never seen that as even an issue on a poll, and in a number of polls, we've seen it as in the top tier one, two, or three issues that people care about. So that's really risen. On the one hand, that's what Democrats are talking about. Republicans, on the other hand, are really talking about kind of classic Republican issues, which is the economy, immigration, and crime. And to that extent, I think that they got a huge boost today from the inflation numbers. So the Republican electorate right now, here's what they want to hear about Donald Trump. But the news that's breaking through to them is the inflation news.
Well, you did my tease for me, because in a minute I'm going to go to break and tell everybody to wait for your comments about the specifics on inflation. We're actually going to break it down even more clearly, because there's some people in this country who are getting hit way harder. And that is really interesting. But before I go there, I still don't want to leave this until I've really gotten the answers I need. And that is about the subpoena. There was one of the officers who died during January 6th, his brother was in the front row there. And when the committee voted unanimously to subpoena Donald Trump, his jaw dropped. He was shocked. I think a lot of people might have been shocked as well. Donald Trump had his reaction. Why didn't you do it sooner? But I wanted to get your thoughts on that. Was this just to provoke some reactions that might be indicting on social media or maybe an interview or a rally somewhere? Or do you think they really are taking their eyes off a different prize in order to get a contempt of Congress, whatever that's going to be? I mean, there's a lot going on, you know, for Donald Trump on the criminal sphere. So what did you make of the whole idea that they want to subpoena Donald Trump?
I think that the committee was trying to make a final statement. This was a summary statement, and they wanted to make news, and they wanted to ring the bell as loudly as they could that, that Donald Trump was the person at the center of this plan, this conspiracy, that it was directed by him. He knew about it beforehand. He helped plan it. I know from our own reporting, from having seen Bannon on our show and Roger Stone, this was all pre-cooked. I mean, they had the Red Mirage strategy, and that they were going to declare victory even if they thought they lost. So it's clear that Donald Trump knew about it beforehand, planned it beforehand, and then executed it. So I think the committee, by throwing out the subpoena, it's so unlikely that that we'll ever see Donald Trump honor that subpoena. But it makes the point, I think, that the committee wanted to make the point, the summary point, that at the end of the day, when it's all cleared out, that Donald Trump was the man behind the curtains.
Okay, one real quick question with a big setup, if I can, Mark, and that's just to show you some of those economy points that you were making, because James Carville said it famously, it's the economy, stupid, for every single election, and boy, is it ever loud this time around. So prices are up 8.2%. They're higher, 8.2% higher than a year ago. That's inflation, right, for all of us. Rents are way up. Rents are up now apparently another 8% from last month, 7.8%. The Dow, however, today soared 800 points. That's always nice to hear if you're struggling against economic news, although I think a lot of Americans don't really feel when stocks go up and down. At least they don't feel it right away. And senior citizens are getting a raise. They, you know, big announcement on Social Security benefits are going to go up 8.7% next year. So I don't think those are all the wash, but the comment I'd like you to make is, when January 6th is screaming in the headlines, is this stuff screaming louder because you can feel it on your back right hip where your wallet's stabbing you?
No question. I did my very first campaign with James Carville, and still the smartest strategist that I know or have ever worked with. You know, I mean, ultimately, these presidential elections are largely just, they are a referendum on how people feel the country is going. And the reason that off-cycle elections like this one, midterm elections, are bad for the party in power is because it's a check. It's a voter's check on the presidential party that was elected 2 years ago, and they often feel that they have overreached. Now, the interesting twist on this one is that, in a way, there's a reaction to a different branch of government, the judicial branch, overreaching on the Roe decision. So that was kind of a pushback that we haven't seen this unprecedented. Yeah. So we're in an uncharted territory. But to your point, I think at the end of the day, we get really complicated about all of this when it's really pretty simple, which is people sit back and they say, do I feel good about where things are headed? And if they don't, they just say, let's switch teams.
Yeah, that's often it. Okay, so to that point, when we come back after the break, I want you to stay where you are, Mark. You know, not all states are created equal when it comes to inflation. Turns out some of us are getting walloped a little bit harder. After the break, I'm going to tell you which states are actually paying more than the other states and why that's happening and if it'll make a difference. That's next. Welcome back. What's in your wallet? It is not just a credit card slogan. It's actually motive for voters. Prices jumped 8.2% in September compared to a year ago. But what you might not realize is that inflation doesn't hit every part of the country the same. The financial site Wallet Hub compared 23 different metro areas across the country to find out which cities are getting hit harder by inflation. And this is what they found. In Phoenix, prices are up 13% from last year, and that stinks. In Atlanta, 11.7%. Miami, Tampa, Baltimore, more than 10%. But on the other side of the scale, Minneapolis is up just 7.4%. Honolulu, Washington, and New York around 6%. And San Francisco, they made out the best at just 5.7%. All five of those cities, by the way, come in under the national inflation rate of 8.2%. So will voters in those cities vote to keep the status quo? Will the cities who see high inflation vote to change? Or is any increase in inflation too much inflation? Mark McKinnon is still with me, former advisor to George W. Bush, John McCain, co-host of Showtime's The Circus. You know, I don't like that list. I live in the New York area. It doesn't jazz me to know that I'm not that bad off, you know, up, you know, 5-7%. But inflation happens to be the worst in Arizona, Georgia, and Florida. And those are possible swing states. So what do the Democrats have to do to overcome that very ugly fact?
Yeah, that's a really interesting list, Ashley, because if you look at the five least affected, those are all like the most Democratic cities you can imagine. And the cities where it's highest, particularly the first two, are in key swing states in Georgia and Arizona, where we have where the Senate could be decided. I mean, we have Blake Masters' race against Senator Kelly in Arizona, and then the Warnock-Walker race, which will have an interesting debate this Friday. But those are two really key states that could make the difference about whether or not it's a Republican or Democratic Senate. And the inflation numbers in those states can only help Republicans at a critical point in the campaign. This is where you really want to get the wind at your back, and that's precisely what these inflation numbers will likely do for Republican candidates.
It's called spin for a reason, and I'm wondering if they could spin it by saying, oh, look, the places where inflation's the lowest are run by Democrats. Yay for us. Is that something they can do, or does that just sound nutty?
Well, I think they're going to try and do is, as you reported, the one good thing going for Democrats in the Biden administration is that likely in anticipation of these inflation numbers, they have built in an increase in Social Security benefits for older Americans. And that should help in places like Florida, right, with an aging population. Mm-hmm. The problem with that is that people never believe that. It's like telling them they're going to get a tax cut. They just don't ever believe it.
And they don't always feel it either. Always good to talk to you, Mark McKinnon. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Take it, Ashley.
Look forward to the next episode of The Circus, too. All right, still to come, a jury speaks in Florida, and families of Parkland kids who were shot by a school shooter there speak out in disgust.
If this was not the most perfect death penalty case, then why do we have the death penalty at all?
The killer's mental illness may have spared him from the death penalty. So, is America's growing concern for mental health going to spare more killers from execution? I'll ask one of the world's leading experts on juries when we come back. Welcome back tonight. We know that most of the jurors who were deciding the fate of the Parkland High School shooter thought that he deserved to die. But the foreman now says that three people on the panel did not. And since verdicts of guilt or the death penalty, for the most part, have to be unanimous, Nicholas Cruz will instead be sentenced to life in prison. And he will never, ever, ever get out until he goes out in a body bag. But the families of his victims are outraged by that. 17 of those victims were gunned down in the hallways of Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School on Valentine's Day in 2018. Nicholas Cruz fired more than 300 rounds, shooting at students who were trying to run away, sometimes going back to make sure that his victims were dead. But his life will be spared. It is the deadliest mass shooting ever to go on trial in this country. Victims' families were inside the courtroom as the sentencing verdict was read, some of them shaking their heads, holding themselves, some of them crying. One victim's son just got up and stormed out. Others said they were disgusted.
We are beyond disappointed with the outcome today. This should have been the death penalty, 100%. 17 people were brutally murdered on February 14, 2018. I sent my daughter to school, and she was shot 8 times.
So what were the so-called mitigating factors? Those factors that moved three of the jurors to vote for life over death. The defense cited fetal alcohol syndrome, antisocial personality disorder, and other mental impairments on that young man. But those things don't make the magnitude of the crime any smaller or the survivor's pain any less. As one family member asked, if monsters like Nicholas Cruz don't warrant a trip to death row, then who does? Florida Governor Ron DeSantis pointed out that Cruz is being treated the same as criminals with lesser charges.
That means that this killer is going to end up getting a same sentence of people who've committed bad acts, but acts that did not rise to this level. I just don't think anything else is appropriate except a capital sentence in this case.
Is the jury verdict today at all a harbinger of what might be to come? as Americans start prioritizing mental health in this country, are more jurors going to look at those defendants and punish less? I'm joined now by renowned jury consultant Joellen Demetrius. It's good to see you, Joellen. Thanks for joining me. I was astounded. I'm not going to lie. I thought this was a layup, given that it's Florida. And you and I have done so many trials together where we see it happens all the time, and yet it didn't on this one. 17 kids. That's the worst of the worst, and yet he didn't get what the death penalty was made for. What do you suppose is the reason?
Well, I think it's probably within all the mitigating factors. You spoke of some of them just a moment ago. Apparently, there were 41 mitigating factors. And in a capital case, what happens is unanimously, they have to decide for one factor in aggravating, which obviously they did. And then that brings in the mitigating factors. I don't know what all 41 mitigating factors were. I do know that one of them was his plea and any sort of remorse that he may have shown. I think that those are really the key to why those three people voted the way they did.
So there's the other idea that, you know, we are becoming a more enlightened society when it comes to mental illness, mental health, and what it can do to someone. And I'm curious if you think that either had an effect on some of those jurors deliberating the most heinous, cruel, and atrocious crimes that I've seen in a courtroom, or if it might start having an effect as you go forward, because this is your job, right? You have to pick the jurors that, you know, the person hiring you wants to see the right outcome. Do you think you're going to have to start looking at what jurors are being voir dired who are very soft on the idea of mental health?
Oh, I think definitely that has to be a consideration, and it always has been in capital cases that I have worked on. I think that the mental health issue is something that is much more in the forefront than it was even 5 years ago. But I think it also goes to the juror themselves and being able to theoretically apply the death penalty versus being there and being the one. Many people themselves feel as though when they vote for the death penalty, they're actually giving the injection themselves. So I think that a key to knowing about those three jurors would have been the voir dire at the beginning of the process.
So I only have a few seconds left, but I think this is important for people out there who don't know. When those jurors come in and they're asked all those voir dire questions, there's a process called death qualifying. You have to be death qualified in order to be accepted on a jury, meaning you can't come in and say, I disagree with death penalty altogether. You have to be okay with it, be an open mind. But do you think that death qualifying now, given the fact that so many more people, so many more of the jury pool are attuned to the mental health crisis in the country, do you think that death qualifying process is going to be more difficult?
I think it potentially can be more difficult. And certainly just in the years that I've been in the business, that process has changed tremendously. So where it goes from here, I think will be a point of discussion amongst people in the judiciary and the public. And I might finish by saying that my sympathies go out to all of those families and the loved ones that they lost.
Agreed. I'm there with you. Joellen, always good to see you. Thank you so much. Good to see you.
Thanks, Ashley.
Still ahead tonight, Kevin Bacon coming out with a shocking confession, how he fell more than 6 degrees away from his money from the biggest con man in history. That's next. If you lost a fortune in a pyramid scheme that, let's face it, you should have seen on day one, would you want the whole world to know about it? What if a lot of your colleagues and contemporaries fell for the same scam from the biggest known scammer in history? You might still take your losses in silence, but not Kevin Bacon. On this week's episode of the hit podcast Smartless, Bacon is making a huge confession about the ill-fated dealings that he and his wife, Kira Sedgwick, had with the late Bernie Madoff.
We had most of our money in Madoff.
Oh, yeah,
Yeah, there's obvious life lessons there. You know, if something is too good to be true, it's too good to be true.
Right.
Yeah.
And when something like that happens, you know, you look at each other and you go, well, that sucks. And let's roll up our sleeves and get to work. You know, we've made it this far. Our kids are healthy.
I can't say I'd be as gracious and grounded, but I know my next guest would be. Joining us now, our friend Caitlin Becker, senior reporter for thedailymail.com. So I listened to Smartless. I love it. It's hilarious. That one was not funny at all, and it was a real jaw dropper. I think it sort of caught a lot of people in the entertainment industry by surprise.
It definitely did. Certainly the two other hosts on the podcast had no idea this had happened. But, you know, me working in this industry for as long as I had, I was certainly aware that Kevin Bacon and Kira Sedgwick were some of the, you know, countless people who had lost millions of dollars at the hands of Bernie Madoff. But a lot of time has passed since then. So it was interesting to hear it get sort of trudged up again. And, you know, ahead of the clip that you played, it was interesting when Sean Hayes had asked about it. He said, we can cut this if you don't want to talk about it, because as you mentioned, it's not something that a lot of people, particularly people in the public eye, want to admit that they were hoodwinked by a fraudster.
I mean, listen, it was humiliating, and there were some real smart people. Let me just remind our viewers of the list of those who got taken by Bernie Madoff. Steven Spielberg, don't know how much he lost. Sandy Koufax, don't know how much he lost. John Malkovich, $670,000. Larry King, $700,000. Zsa Zsa Gabor, $7 million. Elie Wiesel, $12 million. Jeffrey Katzenberg, $20 million. Fred Willopon of the New York Mets, $500 million. I guess what we didn't know was that Kevin and Kira said that they'd lost most of their money. We knew that he was an investor, but we didn't know he was all in. And my God, I hope he, in the last, you know, decade, has been able to make it back.
Yeah, it's such a terrifying prospect to think that you put essentially all your eggs in one basket. I think that's why they tell you not to do that. But he didn't give an exact number, but Kevin Bacon did intimate that it was a good portion, majority of their savings. And that's petrifying. He did make it a point, though, to, as you said, be very gracious about the loss of that money. They are in a very different position than a lot of people who are not as well known. I mean, you're Kevin Bacon and you're Kira Sedgwick. You're two very well known, very famous working actors who were still young enough to keep on working. So they had the benefit of being able to rebuild after that. And, you know, not everybody wants to hear rich people losing money, and people tend not to necessarily feel bad for them. But you work hard for your money, and no matter how much you have, if it's stolen from you, that's a tragedy.
Well, and if you're up that high and you fall that far, it's pretty damn painful as well. No matter how much you have, if you lose all of it, it hurts the same. Caitlin Becker, thank you. Good to see you. Look forward to the next one. All right, talk about pumpkin spice. Border Patrol finds a tricky little treat inside a couple of Halloween pumpkins. And let's just say, not safe for kids. Wonder what it was? I'm going to give you 400,000 guesses. Strategy, but a couple of guys driving up from Mexico through Eagle Pass, Texas, had kind of a different Halloween strategy in mind. Because inside their Ford Escape, Halloween decorations when asked if they had anything to declare. It turns out they forgot to declare the 136 condoms that were packed inside the pumpkins. And no, condoms are not illegal. But the $400,000 worth of liquid meth that was stuffed into those condoms, that's 44 pounds of meth in total. Yeah, that's illegal. The dope was seized, and the alleged smugglers will likely be spending Halloween night in the hospitality of the Maverick County Sheriff's Office. That's how that works. And just to end the show tonight, I hope you will indulge me for just a hot minute, personal minute. No matter how you feel about today's January 6th hearings, there is something bigger that all of us have to wrestle with. How much do you love where you live? How much do you love it here? How much do you love this country? If you were born here, congratulations. You are one of the luckiest people in the world. You did not have to lift a finger to get here. But if you're like me, it was a goal to come here, to stay here, and then to become an American citizen. And it took a lot of work. And I really, really wanted it. And two American husbands, two American children, and 27 years, and I have never looked back. But today, watching the last of the January 6th hearings into how and why an angry mob that was hoodwinked into believing that our prized election system here somehow didn't work, I actually was almost brought to tears over that. Because it did work. Follow the facts, not Facebook. follow the courts, not TikTok. Those Americans on January 6th were lied to. And they did something that likely 10 years ago they would never have dreamed of doing. Something that we typically see in other countries. You know, those countries on the news that really don't seem to have it together like we do? Those people went outside the system and they got violent to get their way. And it almost worked. Almost. If you don't like the way your leaders are leading you, run for office yourself. Get out the vote. Campaign for somebody else. Do it the way our founding fathers asked us to. Because this place is great. And trust me, I have been to almost 50 other countries around the world, and there is no comparison. But if you stay in your angry bubble, your left bubble or your right bubble, you are driving a wedge into dangerous cracks that are in this country. Frankly, they can still be repaired. Just consider the closing remarks of one Liz Cheney, congresswoman, who, as a staunch Republican, whose dad was vice president, decided that principle was more important than party or presidential fealty. And I get it. I know politics is a team sport, but sometimes players cheat. And for the most part, we don't stand for that, on the field or on the Hill. And Liz Cheney did not. Regardless of what you think the best direction for this country is, the framework we have seems to have done the trick so far. And it's kept us, you know, more than intact. I'm going to leave it to the Congresswoman, Ms. Cheney, who said it much better than I ever could.
So as we watch the evidence today, please consider where our nation is in its history. Consider whether we can survive for another 246 years. Most people in most places on earth have not been free. America is an exception. And America continues only because we bind ourselves to our founders' principles, to our Constitution. We recognize that some principles must be beyond politics, inviolate, and more important than any single American who has ever lived. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
That's what you call a mic drop. Thanks, Liz Cheney, and thank you for watching, everybody. I'll see you again tomorrow night.